Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Earl Waters, and he'll be answering your most important questions on giant Homosassa tarpon. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Earl a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and then we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you just return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc. Doing business is Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Earl Waters about fly fishing for giant Homosassa tarpon. Attention fly fishers, the Federation of Fly Fishers has an online fundraising auction going on right now. Find everything from guided fishing trips and fly casting lessons to equipment, FFF memorabilia, and more. Go to the FFF website, and that's at fedflyfishers.org, and on the homepage, click on the banner for Holiday Online Auction. New items are added each week, so keep checking them out, and you may get that trip of a lifetime, that rod you've always wanted, or a collection of the flies tied by the masters. Many items are going for prices you don't want to miss. And while you're on the website, you can renew your membership or join the FFF, the organization that supports fly fishers the world over. The mantra, all fish in all waters, says it all. Call to form a club and if your area needs one, and your active participation and tax-deductible contributions support the FFF in its missions to educate, conserve, and restore on behalf of all fly fishers. While you're on the website, you can even register your Albertsons grocery card, and every purchase you make with the card supports the FFF, the Federation of Fly Fishers. So go to fedflyfishers.org, check out the online auction, and good luck bidding. Before we introduce Earl, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our first drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So there you go. You can become an active member at no charge. And then we're also giving away a 1-year subscription to the Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win in our drawing tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and then look for the link under Earl's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll be announcing those winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And to win that, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. So Earl and I are going to chat, and something we chat about will be in the form of a question at the end of the show. If you're the first person that submits your answer along with your name and location, then you'll win that $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And you can redeem that either online or in their shop. So, okay, our guest tonight is Captain Earl Waters. Earl is a lifelong resident of Florida. He got his first taste of fishing for giant tarpon at Homosassa. And since then, Earl has become what some would call a tarpon addict, leading his customers to hundreds of tarpon in the 150-pound range, at least a half a dozen of which have been lost were considered to be 200-pound fish. Over the years, Earl has had the opportunity to guide a few fishing celebrities, Steve Rajeff, Al Pfluger, Stu Apt, Lee and Joan Wolf, Mark Sosin, and Joe Robinson, and Roland Martin, all of which are record holders for casting or record fish. Earl has set the standards and pioneered the way for catching many species of fish that roam the skinny waters of Homosassa. Earl's strong convictions to the preservation of the environment has led him to a strong supporter and board member of several conservation associations. Earl currently resides in the small town of Homosassa, Florida, but is equally at home most anywhere in Florida's remote waters. Earl has spent the last several decades following fish he likes best, tarpon, cobia, snook, bonefish, permit, and redfish. Today you may see Captain Waters fishing the Florida Keys, the Caribbean, South America, or right in his own backyard pursuing those giant tarpon. Well, Earl, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be on board tonight.
Well, good, good. Good to have you. And I think we'll have a fun time tonight exploring the Homo sassa tarpon. It's quite well known in the fishing industries, but I don't think really people know the inside out of the whole thing, so hopefully you can enlighten us.
Well, the interesting thing about Homo sassa is that you can be in the town of Homo sassa in the middle of tarpon season and not even realize what's going on. That's how remote it is, and quite a little sleepy fishing village that has a lot of interest for people in golf and fishing, but the tarpon take a special place amongst a fraternity of fishermen. Outside of that, there's a lot of people don't even know what's going on until possibly a world record's caught, and then it's in the paper, and you know, people question. Not like the Boca Grande area where everybody knows that the tarpon scene's going on, but we kind of like it that way here, Roger.
Nice and quiet, huh? Tell us, because we have listeners from all over the world, actually, and enlighten us as to where Homo sassa is, and maybe give us kind of a lay of the land around the town of Homo sassa.
Actually, Roger, I believe there's people who live in Homo sassa that don't know where Homo sassa is. I had a conversation in the post office yesterday with the postmaster, and we got Homo sassa, we got Old Homo sassa, and we got Homo sassa Springs, but it's all in one general area, and we're actually only about an hour and 15 minutes from the Tampa International Airport. We've got an expressway that comes right into our front door here now, so it makes it pretty easy to get to, a little better known. We're an hour and a half from Disney in Orlando, so it's easy to get to from there. So we're on the west coast of Florida, north of Tampa, in what's considered just below the Big Bend area, I guess. But we are on the Gulf Coast. We're not on the ocean. We're on the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay. And what is the land and the water like around there?
We don't have beaches south of us. You'll have beaches in the Clearwater area. You know, they refer to them as Clearwater beaches. We really don't have beaches here. We have wetlands that mostly freshwater. We have about seven different freshwater rivers that contribute to our area, which makes our salinity different. And for that reason, we find that it makes it very unique for the tarpon that are seeking this area for the for certain salinity, certain pH. Seems to be a factor in why we have the big tarpon that show up here, you know, in the summertime. We have a water depth approximately 1 foot per mile. So if you're 7 miles offshore, you're in approximately 7 feet of water. And so that makes our coastline a very shallow area. And when you look at it on a topographical or satellite imagery, you'll see that it's made up of a thousand of little keys, little islands, that from here to the Everglades is probably the most vast area of backcountry between here and there. So we have a lot of inshore species, and the tarpon seem to come here from open water. That migrate in here. We have our coastal tarpon as well, but the fish that we target, the giant tarpon that Homo sassa is known for, they migrate in here, and usually it's sometime in late April or 1st of May. It's a unique area because we have a lot of pristine, very clear water that you can sight cast all the different species. Tarpon is certainly a sight casting fish for us here. To the north, we have a little darker water because of some of the contributaries, and that darker water, we don't shun it because it often warms up a little faster than our Gulf water does because of the darker color. And often that will get the water temperature to where the bait will get in there sooner, and also get some of the other species, and particularly the tarpon in the springtime will show up in that darker water before they'll show up in our clear water.
So around all these waters, is it mangrove? Primarily, or
we do have
grassland.
We have a lot of grass flats, and interesting enough, when you go out of the Homo sassa River and go to the north, you'll find more mangrove islands, and when you go to the south, you'll find more sawgrass type of islands that are in that area. We have more probably black mangroves, which is more like a tree than a bush. We do have the reds and the whites, but we have mostly black mangroves, which they grow much taller. Cold weather is subject to knock them back, but global warming has allowed our mangroves to continue to grow and flourish here in the last 10 years. It's been some time since we've had a freeze that killed them back. So we have protective areas. We have areas in the backcountry that are protective. Our tarpon are pretty well known for their coastal movement and not so much the inshore. We don't have the so-called baby tarpon, even though we do have some baby tarpon. We don't really recognize it as an area that you'd find a lot of baby tarpon. But we have rivers that water temperature stays consistent, and when the tarpon are migrating back to the south in the fall, they'll enter our river systems, and they'll stay in the headwaters of Crystal River. They'll stay in the headwaters of the Homosassa, along with some really giant snook as well. So we actually have a winter's fishery here that a lot of people are not even aware of. Just yesterday, I had an opportunity before this cold front that came today to go out and pursue some tarpon. I saw two tarpon. We caught one, but we did find two tarpon yesterday. But we could have easily found 50 or 100 of them if they had been in that location. So it's not what we have considered in the past, Roger, as being a year-round tarpon fisheries. But as our climate gets warmer and warmer, it seems that we're getting more opportunities for that.
We did get since you kind of brought this up, a question from Bob Tabbert in South Louisiana, and not that that has anything to do with Florida, but they do have tarpon down there. And his question was, in South Louisiana, several people have caught small tarpon in shallow marsh ponds several miles inland. Is this a common occurrence? And you just mentioned you don't get too many baby tarpon in your area.
Not well, and when we say my area, it depends on how vast you want to go. We go 30 miles south of here, and there's an area there that it seems to hold a fair amount of baby tarpon in the fall and in the winter. You can just about go in there on any given day and find these baby tarpon. Whether you get them to eat or not, it's one thing, but they are certainly in those same type of areas that they're talking about in South Louisiana. Louisiana has got a very vast area of shallow water. They've got a lot of soft bottom with dark stained water and even muddy water, which would also hold their water temperatures up. And we all know that tarpon really like that 75-degree water temperature. So as long as they've got some place to retreat to, that they can stay in that 75 upper range, I can't visualize them not being in places like Louisiana all the way around to Texas. It's just we don't have an abundance of what I call baby tarpon compared to the Florida Keys, which has a tremendous amount of baby tarpon, you know, in the seasons down there.
Right. I guess I want to ask, you know, why is that? Is, you know, you've got these huge, giant tarpon coming into the area, so, and as I understand it, and I guess it's not real clear, but I guess tarpon do not spawn in the shallows, that they spawn at sea somewhere, and then the fry come into the shallows to try to survive. Is that correct?
And this is what the scientists have studied the tarpon have concluded. We saw in the early days. I've been doing this now for 32 years, and I remember the first 8 to 10 years of my career here as a tarpon guide. We would see daisy chains taking place, and we would see the big cow get in the middle of the daisy chain, and they would create that vortex to hold that water close to her, and you would see a fish move out of the school and bump her and turn on their side, and it looked as if someone had poured a gallon of milk in the water. So we actually saw what we believe to be what we've been told that's happening, is that they are spawning. We have seen that in our inshore waters here. In recent years, we haven't seen it as much, but we've had pH changes and things due to the lack of rains, et cetera, that maybe that's the reason that some of our giant fish don't show up like they did. But typically, the research that's been done has told us that it is an offshore thing, but we have actually, a number of us that have been doing this for some time, have actually visualized this happening up close to where we believe that's taking place here. And we may be unique to that more so than any place in the world. But the fact of the matter is they're doing that. We're not seeing the offspring here, and that gives us a question on where the offspring go. Do they go offshore and then move somewhere else? We should see a number of small tarpon compared to the big schools that we used to see years ago, which I say big schools, we're talking about 500 to 1,000 fish in a school that you could see back 25 years ago. So we did see those things taking place, and we feel like that, you know, our eyes are as important as the scientists have done their research. We have actually witnessed something different that we shared with them, but since they haven't seen it, as all scientists, good scientists, they're not going to document anything other than just being hearsay.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's still a big mystery.
It is, and you know, like many species, tagging programs have taken place, but they're slow in the process of giving the results, and it's a long-term thing in order to get really good results. And we believe that our big tarpon come straight from the Atlantic in open water that cross over from some places in Mexico. I know I've done a lot of tarpon fishing in Mexico to try to discover some of the places, and we have certainly encountered some big tarpon and some numbers of schools of tarpon, but not compared to what we've seen here in the past. So if they do come from the deep water and they do come across the Gulf from Mexico, then their patterns have changed and their numbers have dwindled somewhat over the years, and that could be to a number of things. You know, if they come in here and the water's not right for them, I and they're here to spawn, then I don't think they're going to stay around very long.
Okay, good. Has there been any tagging and tracking of tarpon that you know of?
Yeah, Roger, there has been. Some years ago, the NOAA did some research for some tagging. We got some tags. We tagged a number of tarpon. We had tarpon that showed up here that we tagged that end up going to Boca Grande and being found in Boca Grande. I tagged a fish here in Homosassa with Howard West with Scientific Angler some years ago, and that fish showed up the next year in North Carolina and was caught in North Carolina a year later. Mm. That fish was about 125, 130-pound fish, and that's where he, you know, reappeared at with his tag and was caught there. So, and more recently, there has been some tagging, some Boca Grande fish that have been tagged. We've recovered some of their tags. They've had a little more interest in their tagging down there because of our fly fishing versus the way they fish for them, conventional tackle and Boca Grande. They actually land more fish there than what we would here on fly, but we have caught some fish that's been tagged in Boca Grande as well. But there has been some tagging, and there's still some tagging going on. And, of course, now DNA samples are more important to them, and we're doing DNA sampling on all of our fish.
Mm. So you take us in and send that to the researchers?
State of Florida has a program, and they have these little kits that can be acquired at most any of the tackle stores, particularly fly shops. And these kits have a little vial in them, and then they have a what looks like a Brillo pad type of thing. And you just scrub off some of the silver off of their face on their cheek. You don't have to cut a tail or do anything that would be harmful to the fish. And then you put it in that little vial and has an envelope. You mail it in, and they do the research on the DNA based on the scrub that you did.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. Kind of fun to be able to participate in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah.
And then when you see one of those tarpon after you release them, he's got a pretty shiny cheek, and you say, oh, that one's already been caught, you know. Don't even throw the ones with the shiny cheeks, you know. Because it will polish their cheek up a little bit when you remove that DNA off of there.
Yeah, yeah. Earl, how were you first introduced to tarpon?
Well, I was real fortunate in having close ties with some friends in South Florida, being that I was fishing in the Keys a fair amount. I had met in my early days of fishing in the Florida Keys. I'd met Captain John Emery. John became somewhat of a mentor with me, and later on when Homosassa got cranked up and I got tired of hearing John talk about it, I had to show up and give it a go. And when I did, I met his friend, Al Pfluger, Jr. from Miami. And we hit it off real good and shared a house together for several years until I actually decided to move here myself. And then, of course, each year that Al and John would come up, we would share a place together until I finally bought my own home here and continued to stay. And Al continued to come up and stay with us until most of the guys in the Keys that were anybody and everybody that wanted to catch giant tarpon when Homosassa first was recognized for its giant tarpon fishing. That's where all the top name anglers and guides were coming from, was South Florida. Now we have more guides coming from the Boca Grande to Tampa area, is most of the Keys guides. Very few of them actually come up here anymore. But we still have a great fisheries, and we still have some very good tarpon fishing. Not like it was in the old days, but enough to keep us happy and wanting to go back for more.
What makes a Homosassa tarpon different than a Keys tarpon, or is there any difference?
It has to be their size. Yeah, it's, you know, our our fish, when you go through a season here tarpon fishing, and then you go down in the Keys, a lot of times for years I would fish Home Assassin in May and then go fish the tournaments in the Keys in June, and I was always amazed that the fish seemed so much smaller. The numbers are there, but the size was never comparable to what we've had and witnessed in Home Assassin. Even though our size has gone down, our average is less than what it used to be, we still have the majority of our fish are going to be bigger than any of the average key size fish.
Now, is there anything they attribute that to?
Well, the fact that these fish may be offshore tarpon, they may be a strand of tarpon that are coming from offshore, coming from other waters where, you know, a tarpon can live to be 50 plus years old. And these are senior members of the species. And we really don't know why that they seem to hit the Boca Grande area and they seem to hit the Home Assassa area. And of course, these fish, once they get out of Home Assassa, they're going to be moving either to the south or to the north. And a lot of times they come here and move south in the early season. And they're not going to be traveling a lot of what I call pristine clear water. So the fact that we have clear water here, we're really able to identify the fish and their size more so than some of the other areas. When they move to the north and go through the panhandle, they're not necessarily traveling a lot of really clear water. And so they're just not as recognized for their size, other than when people see them roll. And any tarpon that rolls next to a boat from a guy that's out trout fishing is going to look like a giant. You know, you always hear these stories about the tarpon that came by and took your trout while you were trout fishing. But they're always giants to them because they're targeting such a smaller species. But we do seem to have something that has always attracted the very large tarpon here. Boca Grande certainly gets its share of 200-pound plus fish as well. When they go to Boca Grande, they seem to be in a feed. When they come here, they seem to be more interested in each other than they are in actually feeding.
Mm. Now, so you just mentioned a 200-pound fish in Boca Grande, and is that the size fish that you get in Home Assassa then?
Yes, there's been a number. Of course, we have the world record that Jim Holland caught was 202.5 pounds here at Home Assassa a few years back. We know that Billy Pate's fish on 16-pound was 188 pounds on 16-pound test. And of course, we have witnessed and actually have boarded fish over 200 pounds. There's people who come to Home Assassa strictly for the world record aspect. There's people who come here to just up their previous catch and have no interest in doing anything but catching a big fish and releasing it and want to catch the biggest tarpon they can. So there has been some other tarpon that have been caught over 200 pounds, but not documented from an IGFA standard, you know, from killing the fish. And in order to take a tarpon and consider him a world record, he is going to have to, it would be very, very difficult to weigh that fish out of the water on solid ground that IGFA requirements require. So a lot of these fish that have been caught of that size have been released by various people who really wasn't seeking the record.
Yeah, I understand.
But we do have an average size of 130, 140 pounds, I think, is a safe average of our fish, which is certainly...
That's a nice fish.
Yeah, certainly by standards is larger than any Keys fish, even though probably the biggest tarpon I've ever seen came in late evening fishing in the lower Keys. I saw a tarpon come in across the white strip in front of us that we were catching tarpon in that was mammoth. I mean, he was as big as anything or bigger than anything I've ever seen at Home Assassa.
Wow. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Earl, so hold tight and we'll be right back to you. Front Range Angler is a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Earl Waters about giant Home Assassa tarpon. If you'd like to ask Earl a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, before we go on here, Earl, tell us, take just a minute or two and tell us about your business in Homosassa, what you do, what you offer, and be sure to let us know what your website address is and so forth.
Well, over the years, of course, Roger, my main interest has been in the fishing, and because fishing often opens up doors for other opportunities, I've run and maintained a fly shop since 1986. Since that time, we have actually closed it recently because we have ties with a sister company in Guatemala, and we've moved our fly fishing operation to Guatemala as of this past month. I still maintain a company called Backcountry Concepts, which consists of a number of professional fishing guides who we divvy up the different charters that come in, you know, through our website, which is www.backcountryconcepts.com. Then I have another website that is directed towards the fly fishermen, which is www.homosassa-flyfishing.com. And there's a dash between the Homosassa and fly fishing. So that's www.homosassa-flyfishing.com. They can see more about my personal operations. Under the Backcountry Concepts website, we have a section in there concerning the air troll system, which is a pneumatic switching system that I invented some years ago for operating dual trolling motors on the back of tarpon skiffs. We fish a little different here with the way we fish for tarpon is a little different here than what you would in the Keys, but I think we've got that in the program, and we'll talk about that when you're ready.
Yeah, good. Well, thanks for sharing that, and now these folks know how to get in contact with you.
Yeah, I got an email address there too. Email address, they can jot that down as well, Roger. We can they can go to bccinfo@earthlink.net. That's boy Charlie@earthlink.info@earthlink.net.
Okay, great. So if you have any questions, you want to follow up with Earl after the show, there you go.
Absolutely. I'm sure there'll be questions that come up and we'd like for the listening audience to feel free to contact me, and I'll share anything and everything I can with them.
Well, we've got a question here from Don Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee, and he says he'd like to plan a 7 to 10 day trip that would start with a guided trip, but he also wants to know if there are locations in the area where someone could then wade without a guide, and then possibly for other fish species in the area. You want to kind of address that before we get into tarpon stuff?
Certainly, Don is certainly on the right cue there. I don't travel with my vast knowledge of inshore and offshore fishing. I don't ever travel to a new location without contacting a guide in that area before I go and make arrangements to fish with him and tell him what my plans are and what I would like to do. And I've never found where they're not accommodating. When you're up front with your guide and telling him what you're wanting to do and you're wanting to strike out on your own, he can usually send you in a direction of where you can target that as a species, you know, on your own. Because of our water depth here and because of our estuaries being very shallow, there are some places that you can certainly get to the wade fish without a boat. They're somewhat limited, but there certainly wouldn't be a situation if we were going to target tarpon. Tarpon just don't come into that shallow water where you would be wading at. If you were targeting other species, yes, you could do that. But I think you did ask about what other species were in the area.
Right.
And there's redfish, snook, sea trout, cobia, sharks, bluefish, bonita in the fall. They're in deeper water, of course, but they wouldn't be a wading fish. But jack crevalle are great fish this time of the year. The cold weather pushes the jacks into the warmer river estuaries, and you can certainly wade fish and hook into those species as well. But if it was tarpon that you were wanting to wade for, no, you wouldn't be able to do that in this area.
Okay, great. Sounds like a lot of fish to catch in that area. Okay, let's talk a little bit about equipment. Frank Dizell in Lanceville, B.C., British Columbia. He actually had several questions, which I've broken up into the different sections here. So, Frank, we'll try to get to all your questions here. But his... talking about equipment, he says, would you please outline the tackle one should bring, including a discussion on reels, brands you have tried and are recommended, and also rods, amount of backing needed, lines, etc. He says he owns an FR5 Islander reel, which was made for big game saltwater fish, and he's wondering, you know, would that be sufficient for the tarpon? So can you kind of...
Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe just kind of address all that.
Yeah, no problem. And he's asked all the right questions. You know, Frank's doing his homework there, and that's important. And what I'd like to share with Frank is to leave it all at home. And when you pick the right guide, he'll have all the equipment that you can imagine, and it'll be rigged and ready to go for the type of fishing that we do in this area. And I only mention that because of the hassles that we have with airlines and traveling with our luggage anymore, and how little that we can actually carry. Bringing your favorite reel, by all means, is easy enough to pack in your carry-on so that you don't lose it. I always recommend to carry your most valuables. Leave your clothes in the cargo section and bring your tackle and your camera and your carry-on. And he doesn't even have to bring that, but if one does, and people do like to have their own equipment, he's certainly in the right ballpark with the Islander reel, Charlton reels, T-bores, Abels, Fenors. All of these reels have been proven reels at Homosassa and over the years, and most everybody uses the direct drives. I do see people show up with hand reverse reels, and they certainly can do the job. If you're familiar with that, just be familiar with your tackle that you're using. And this is why some people like to bring their own stuff, is because they feel more comfortable with casting their own rod and casting their own rig. And we can change fly lines for them. We can change leader lengths and tippet sizes and stuff. Any knowledgeable fishing guide should be able to do that. And any tarpon guide certainly is going to know his work well enough to do what's needed for the customer, put him in the right direction and hook him up with the right materials.
I haven't been to Homosassa yet on my list of places to go, but,
your bucket list, huh?
Yeah, my bucket list. But, you know, we fished for tarpon down off Key West, and it was actually a pleasure to just arrive there and have that gear ready to go, and knowing that that gear was the way that the guide liked it and was successful for that guide. So, you know, unless you're down there, I think a whole lot, time after time, maybe many times a year, I don't think it pays as an infrequent visitor to try to rig yourself up. It's very expensive. And
Roger, I agree. I have probably 90% of my fly fishing customers that will use my gear. I know in advance, and if a customer does tell me that he wants to use my gear, I found out if he wants to be right-handed or left-handed, because everyone has their preference on that. Some people have been schooled to believe that regardless of if you're right-handed, you should reel right-handed. If you're left-handed, you should reel left-handed. But to the contrary, I found that to be different with a number of people. I'm dominant right-handed, and I can reel as fast as my left hand, but I fight fish a whole lot harder with my right arm. So I reel with my left. But, a guy needs to be familiar with his tackle. And if he's not, I'm going to have both right hand and left hand, you know, on board, so that if one seems inferior to him, that he can switch. When it comes to rods, what we're really, you know, we're looking at some really high modulus rods today. We're looking at rods that cast really good. But when it comes to fishing Homosassa tarpon, my opinion is you want a 12-weight rod. You don't want to do anything less than a 12-weight rod. In some cases, it may say it may be a 13, but a good 12-weight rod is the tool of choice, in my opinion. And I say that because even if you encounter a 50-pound fish, a 50-pound fish can put a lot of heat on a 12-weight rod. He can give you a lot of pull, he can give you a lot of action, and you still have to work a 50-pound fish pretty hard. Even though you can catch a 50-pound fish on a 9-weight, you just may take a lot longer doing it. And if you got a 9-weight out there and you're targeting 150-pound fish, then you're going to be in an inferior situation. And my feeling is we don't need to kill these fish from fighting them. We need to fight them hard, fight them fast, get a lot of jumps out of them, fight them to the boat if you wish. Some people prefer just to get the jumps and then break them off. But most people who come to Homosassa do want to get them within the range of get a close-up of them, you know, take a picture beside the boat, et cetera, because they are considered trophy fish. And so I recommend nothing less than a 12-weight. You see a lot of things said about tippet size and all, and tippet size is certainly acceptable, but, you know, you're not going to You're not going to do very well with a 12-weight rod if you're fishing a 6-pound tippet, because the rod's going to be too much for that tippet. And if you're going to try to fish a 6-pound tippet, you got a lot of choices of fish in the Florida Keys that you could break records on 6-pound. So I recommend the, you know, the 16 to 20-pound, the 12-pound class is still a doable class in Homosassa, but I certainly recommend the 12-weight rod for the average angler.
And what of Mike Adamson in Orlando, around the corner from you there? Mike also had several questions here tonight. He wanted to know what line do you use most often, sinking, floating, sink tip, and what's your go-to rigging? We also had another line question by Bill in Orlando, and again, Mike Adamson, can you walk us through how you build your leaders? So maybe you can kind of talk about line and leader, you know, terminal tackle here.
Yeah, my answer to Mike is over the years, you know, Mike, we have tried all the different fly lines that's become down on the market. I had an opportunity to work real close with Scientific Anglers for years, work with Rio and their lines, and they've all got lines that will do the job. My go-to line, the line that I am most excited about and use exclusively now through the whole season, is the Monic fly line. It's a clear floating fly line. The only people that's had a clear line that would actually, you know, float. And my whole reason for this is our water is clear. These fish are as the season bears on, they're the same fish every day that we're fishing, and they become very conscious of the fly lines being in and around them. And you can get away with a lot of mistake of lining fish and what we call fencing fish, but you can get away with some things that you can't get away with sinking lines. Sink tips are very popular amongst a lot of anglers. Guys who have been doing this for a while like the sink tip because they like to get their fly down to the level of the fish. I do that basically by the weight of the fly and by the length of my leader. But I'm really fond of the Monix floating fly line. This past year, I noticed that an angler who won quite a few of the tournaments in the Keys contributed his success to that same fly line. So I use a 12-weight floating Monic for all of my tarpon fishing, no matter where I'm tarpon fishing at anymore. I think he was asking about is your go-to rigging. Pardon?
Yeah, your terminal tackle, how you do your leader and so forth.
Yeah. And the leader, you know, the leader system that I'm using today is the same leader system that I was introduced to by John Emery and Al Pfluger 30 years ago. We're rigging those as a Huffnagel. We're using a Huffnagel, and we're using on the Homosassa fish. We don't use anything less than an 80-pound bite tippet. I typically use a 100-pound bite tippet because we do often have them chew through 80-pound, particularly the fluorocarbon. We use the fluorocarbon on our whole leader system. We use it on the buck section as well as on the class tippet as well as the bite tippet. So I'm using an 80-pound to 100-pound on the bite tippet. I'm using whether it be 16 or 20-pound test on the class. I'm using that with the most familiar Huffnagel knot that has been so popular for so long. And then I use a loop knot in the end of that so I can change out my leaders. Late in the season, the fish get a little spooky, and just to get a bite sometimes you'll drop down to 50-pound, but you're really subject to lose a lot of fish if you're using a 50-pound, you know, bite tippet.
How long is that old leader system?
Well, you know, we hardly ever throw anything less than a 9-foot leader. It's often a 12-foot leader is very common. I have gone as long as 14, but most of the time it's in that 11 or 12-foot length. The shortest that I would do is a 9-foot length. When late into the season, the fish are coming through some shallow water, the water is only 2 to 3 feet deep, then I'll drop down to a 9-foot leader because I don't have to have the sink time, you know, with the shallower water. Our typical depth is 4 to 7 feet that we're fishing these fish in. I haven't mentioned that to you, but it's to give people an idea, we're fishing these fish in 4 to 7 feet pretty much most of the time in open water. We're not fishing fish along shorelines or channels or anything of that nature. It's all open water. It's called the area that's been so known for years is nicknamed Oklahoma. Oklahoma because it's flat and a broad flat. The depth's about the same throughout the whole flat and very little structure on that flat. And it looks like a desert from a bird's view, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about that and your strategies here in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Is that leader a tapered leader? Or is that just straight
The leader that we're using, we're starting out with like a 50-pound test, and then we're dropping down to our, and we're using about 4 feet of 50-pound test, dropping down to our class tippet, which is around 22 inches long, and then a foot of the bite tippet.
So just three sections, basically?
Yeah, so we vary our butt section. Our butt section, you know, making up 4 feet minimum, we would vary that. We don't vary the class tippet or the bite tippet. The bite tippet has to be, you know, 12 inches from the knot to the eye of the hook. So we stay by IGFA standards for two reasons, because if we catch a world record and want to enter it, we need to have it built to that standard. The fly stretchers that we use are all designed to fit for that those dimensions, you know, of the class tippet along with the bite tippet. So our fly stretchers are set up to fit the IGFA standard leaders.
There's probably a lot of freshwater fishermen here that don't know what a stretcher is. Can you describe that? And do you make your own, or do you use commercial stretchers?
I do make my own. There's a number of stretchers that's come about over the years. I've made my own for a number of years. I make a teak stretcher that holds 42 flies, and then I have a what I call a drying stretcher that's built into the hatch of my boat, my front hatch. When I open it up, I have a stretcher there so that when we take a fly off that we've used, and whether we've gotten a bite from it or decided just to change it, I'll hang it in that stretcher that's in the boat. That way I don't get mixed up the ones that have not been rinsed, because I do like to rinse the flies, you know, after they've been in salt water. And it may be that if a tarpon comes up and eats a fly and scuffs up the bite tippet, then, of course, we want to change that out. And I may hang that just to dry for that day and then cut it off later that night and inspect the fly. And the fly is usable, I'll retie it on another leader. But it is just an area that I have to dry them in. And, of course, the leader box itself, you know, is a case, a soft case that's built on a teak frame that holds 42 rigged tarpon flies.
Okay. And the purpose of the stretcher is?
Is to keep our leader straight, our class tippet. We want that class tippet to be straight, but that's not as important as our bite tippet, because our bite tippet being anywhere from 80 pounds to 100 pounds plus, that's where you're going to get your kink at. If you can keep that straight, then you can get straight tracking of your fly. I do use a loop knot on the end of all of my flies. They dive a little faster. Some people like to snell them, but the type of hook that I use a loop knot, so that stretcher keeps that tension enough on between the hook and the first knot. It keeps enough tension on that first foot there that it stays straight.
Well, Earl, we need to take another short break, but hang tight. Well, I'll be right back with you.
All right.
Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option to wade fish trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Earl Waters about giant homosassa tarpon. If you'd like to ask Earl a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, I have gotten a few questions in on the Internet, and just so you guys know, sometimes I hold back on these until they kind of better fit into what we're talking about. So just be patient. I'm sure we'll get to your question. Got Don in the Bozon. This is probably my old interviewing partner here, Don Bishop, up in Bozeman. He wants to know, is there any chance of getting into tarpon in the Fort Myers and St. Pete areas in February?
In February. Well, you know, that area, when you get down to Fort Myers, certainly you're further south than what you are at Homosassa, and they're like our area, we have some warm water contributaries, some of them being power plants and some of them just being river systems. And that's what holds our fish here during the wintertime is those type of areas. So I certainly would talk to any of the fly shops down there that are in that area, I'd recommend going online and finding some Florida Sportsman has a blog online. You can talk to different people in that area, and you can get a handle on what's going on with those. But I do believe they'll find, you know, some tarpon in that area as well. We have them here in the winter. They're further south than we are, so they certainly should have some in and around their power plants as well as their warm water rivers that, you know, they're the contributaries.
Yeah, good. Okay, did you have some more to say about the terminal tackle?
I just wanted to make a note there concerning the floating fly line, the importance of that. Often when the fish are swimming in a certain column of water, if your fly line is in that column of water and it's at a level that they are and it's across in front of them, they'll actually spook off of that. Whereas with a floating fly line over top of their head, particularly a clear floating line, they'll swim right up underneath it. They'll just go underneath it and pass it a lot of times and not even be aware it's there. It's just amazing to see the difference that a clear line can make versus a line that has color to it. A little harder for the angler to see, but as long as he keeps his eye on his fly when it hits the water and stays in touch with where his fly is at, that may be the reason we use chartreuse more than anything else these days, is that the angler may like it more so than a tarpon, but tarpon certainly seem to like it as well.
Good. Well, let's talk about flies for a few minutes, and then we'll get into some tactics and presentation. We've got George in Texas, and he says, there's been a lot of interest lately in the toad fly. Do you use it, and why do you think it's effective? How do you fish?
George, I got to tell George that he's found out our secret to tarpon fishing. All the years of tarpon fishing, the toad fly seems to be the fly that these fish really really do are attractive to. It's something about the toad fly, and it's all tarpon fishing is. You know, the most predictable thing about tarpon is they're unpredictable. But over the years we've used a number of different creations, and sometimes they'll eat your shoestrings if you threw them out there. But for the most part, we want something that's dependable and reliable every day. And the toad fly design has taken on some different dimensions. The early toads, I think, had rabbit strips behind them, zonker strips. But all of the toad designs that, and I guess you could call it a toad design that I use myself or tie myself, is all done with a marabou body. You know, the tail is all marabou, and the head is tied with a yarn and a merkin design, like a permit crab merkin. The head is tied in that design, so it's a real simple fly to tie. It's a fly that really gives a lot of life in the water. It's a fly that you can manipulate and add some dimension to it when you're working fish. Something we used to never do, but we do wiggle our toads these days to get their attention. So whatever it takes, somebody is going to try it. When you get refusals, you just don't do it anymore, and when it works, you try it again. And if it continues to work, you stay on that pattern.
Now, does a toad fly actually represent any live animal, or is it just
I've never seen
kind of
anything in the water that looks like it. what they see it as, and it certainly doesn't even look like a toad, but I've never seen a toad that looks like a toad fly, so why it's called a toad fly is beyond me. But it does, you know, with the type of a toad or the type of design that I'm using on the so-called toad fly, being that I'm using marabou, as we all know, marabou is a very soft feather, and it insulates in the water very well, and it allows you to suspend as well. So I often would do what I call a slider. I'll use a hair on the front of it. I'll use elk hair, which is, you know, light, it's hollow. It will give me a little suspend rate, and that's really what I'm wanting to do, is I'm wanting that fly to get to a certain level in front of the fish and kind of hold there without having to move it. I want the fish to look at the fly and then react to the look and then move the fly. But the toad fly certainly has been the go-to fly for most all fly fishermen. And you know, the chartreuse color is far removed from what we used to use as earth tones, but chartreuse has been probably one of the number one colors. I use about three colors is about all I use.
Well, that was next question coming up. David Jenkins in Norwalk, Ohio. He says, what are your top five fly patterns, and what colors work best, and in what conditions do you use them? Good question.
Well, I guess we've answered David's question somewhat. It's the toad fly, the toad fly, the toad fly, and chartreuse,
really?
And chartreuse and chartreuse. But no, I like to give David a little better insight here and tell you, David, that I use the toad fly design, but I make it more sparse in some of the models that I do, or some of the flies will tie a little more sparse, some of them a little fuller. And I change that because it does change the sink rate, and sink rate's important to us on the level. We want that fish to see that fly on his level. We don't want it really too far down below him and not too far above him. He will rise for the fly more so than he'll go down for the fly. Tarpon usually will not dive on a fly, but they will rise to the surface on a fly. But once the tarpon are familiar with boat traffic or movement, they won't always surface. There is places that tarpon have been known to take top water flies, and that certainly exists in places like Location X over in Lanark, known to take a top water floating fly, but not so much here at Homosassa. It has happened a few times, but it's not a norm for us. So those top fly patterns are I vary the color between a purple, a chartreuse, a redhead with a white body. An old standby for tarpon for years was a plug that was red and white, but I do use a red and white as well. We use sometimes a mixture of maybe purple and chartreuse, but for the most part, it's probably down to about three flies, and black's always been a good color. But the chartreuse, the black, the purple are all three patterns that are very well known and used in the fly fishing circles, and I throw in a red and white occasionally and get a bite when I may not be able to get a bite on something else, particularly in the darker water. When I'm fishing the darker water, the red and white does very well along with the chartreuse.
Okay. He also asked a couple other questions. Best time of year to go for the giants, and then how did tides affect the fishing?
Well, tides affect all types of fishing. Everybody knows that fish is saltwater. The tide has a big effect on the fish. Tides is not as crucial to me as water temperature. Water temperature is certainly more crucial. 75 degree water temperature is the minimum we want to have. We see activity around 73, but we really start to see fish more active and coming up off the bottom at 75 degree water temperature. And that's surface temperature we're talking about, not subsurface.
Okay.
or bottom surface, but we're talking about surface temperature at 75 degrees. When we can get that, we'll get those fish in that upper water column where we can see them, and they're more active and they're more subject to take, your flies as you throw them to them or any type of bait. It also puts more bait on the flats as well, even though we don't see a tremendous amount of bait. We don't see these fish here at Homosassa chasing bait like they do in other areas. They're here for the reason of what we think they're doing is spawning. So the tides bring the fish in and the tides bring the fish out, and we have some areas later in the season that the fish actually do just the opposite. The fish start coming out on the incoming tide. They lay up in the back in shallower water, and they come out on the incoming tide, and they'll just pour out of the inside, and you'll be back there looking around and never find them, and then all of a sudden the tide changes and here they come. So it's a mystery sometimes where they come and go to, but as the season progresses, we get a better handle on them, and we really monitor that water temperature early in the season, and then we pay closer attention to the tide as we go into the season. So there is variables in every aspect of this, but I don't know that I have five fly patterns, but I have three that David that I mentioned, or three or four there I mentioned to David, but the tides are certainly, they certainly do play a part. Moon phase is what affects our tide, Roger, and of course, I think that we have some of our worst tarpon fishing around that full moon. Before the full moon's good, but on the full moon and the day after the full moon's not so great. A few days after full moon, things get back to normal, but we are affected by a full moon. The fish seem to be more active at nighttime and not so much in the daytime during the full moon period. A new moon, we love a new moon. New moon is we're just chomping at the bit to be there as early in the morning as we can on a new moon.
He asked in the next question, best time of year. Didn't you earlier say for the larger tarpon?
Late April. Late April's when our migrating fish are the claim to fame Homosassa fish show up, as early as the last week of April. Not always guaranteed. Water temperature there predicts that. I've seen the fish not show up until May 15th. But by May 15th, between the last week of April and May 15th, we're going to have the majority of our fish, the mother load, is going to be here during that time frame. You're going to get lucky with some late April fish, early May fish. You'll get lucky if they're here. You'll have some great bites. The early fish do bite good. As you progress into the middle of May, if they haven't come by the middle of May, you'll still have some good bites. So most people start showing up at Homo Sassa by the 1st of May. Some people take a chance and start coming in late April. Being that I don't migrate here like a lot of the guides do, I'm able to take advantage of those early season fish that do show up. A lot of the people that live local or close by that can be on what we call will call. You can call them in April if the fish show up and say, hey, they're here. Can you be here tomorrow? And those people can take advantage of that. If a guy's a long ways away and has got to schedule his time, naturally he's going to want to pick days during the peak season when he can be reassured of having some chances of those fish.
Right. Next question, Roger in Cheyenne, he asked about going down the first week of April, and he wants to know what three flies he would have. Well, you've already kind of covered that, but I want to expand that question. So do you use the same flies no matter what the season, whether it's, prime season, off season?
I do. I vary my size based on the size of the fish. I vary my size based on the water column that the fish are in, whether I want the fly to sink faster or slink slower. The speed of the fish moving during the season, they move much faster during the season when they're in their migration mode. So you want your sink rate to be a little faster. You want to get down to their level because you don't get a lot of time to get out in front of them. So it does matter. Size does matter. Whether it's a 3-inch or 2-inch fly, that does matter. More so in the Florida Keys, we use half of the size fly for the Keys and or Keys tarpon. We'll use a fly that may not be but an inch and a quarter, inch and a half long, very sparsely tied. They see a lot of flies down there, and they're a little pickier than our fish are here. But it's not uncommon for us to use a full body 3-inch marabou with a mother type head or a toad type head on it is our common fly. And these can be all seen on my website as well. I have pictures up there from time to time, and we certainly can share these patterns and colors and designs with anyone who contacts me. I've got that all in my files to where I can send them photographs of how to tie them and how to
identify. That was going to be my next question, because we do have but before we move into to tying them, Mike Adamson wanted to know, does size matter with tarpon? And you just indicated
absolutely.
Size does matter depending on what fishery you're in and how sensitive the fish are. But they don't really need a huge meal, and I don't know if that's what he was getting at.
No. Where a tarpon will eat a 14-inch mullet. He'll eat a 4-pound fish, but when it comes to flies, we certainly wouldn't. I'm glad that we don't have to throw 4-pound flies.
Yeah.
But the our tackle and our physical ability would be certainly overloaded. But they certainly will eat large species. They'll eat large crabs. But yet we'll fish them with a crab pattern that's not but an inch in diameter, and they will take that morsel of whatever it is. And what they identify it as, we're really not sure, whether they think it's a shrimp or a little fish, or certainly our crab patterns are certainly successful for tarpon in many areas of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I use strictly a crab pattern in the Keys most of the time, because I've got the opportunity to throw up bonefish, tarpon, and permit. So
yeah.
I do use a crab pattern a lot for tarpon. But yes, those traditional size flies for tarpon are certainly what we use here. Smaller stuff in the Keys, and I might mention that we're using a 5-0 hook here. The Honor 5-0 that I use hook is more like a 4-0 in actual size. But in the Keys, I may use a 2 or 3 alt hook instead of a 5 alt hook.
Okay.
The bigger fish, we do use the bigger hooks.
Now, you said the fly patterns that you tie and so forth are available on your website, or they have to request those from you?
They can request them. I have them on the website. As the season progresses, we'll put them on there and take them back off as the season progresses. If they're not on there at the time that someone goes on there, they certainly can request an email back to us with those photographs of the flies on there.
And I suppose if they could also order some samples from you and so forth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have someone. I have a girl who ties these flies for us on a regular basis. She's doing it pretty much every day this time of the year, getting ready for the season.
And there again, but you don't have to even bother with that, because most guides will have those available for you anyway.
They don't have to buy a fly one if they come and fish with a guide. Naturally, if they're going to fish one day and strike out on their own, they'd want to buy some flies, but they can do that after they, you know, make contact with me.
Okay, good. Well, let's take another quick break, and then let's talk tactics and presentation here.
All right.
Women's Fly Fishing Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing trips to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email them at pudge@womensflyfishing.net or call them at 907-274-7113. Okay, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Earl Waters about giant homosassa tarpon. If you'd like to ask Earl a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and I'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Here's the first question. We talk about tactics and presentation. Frank Wood, Norwalk, California, says, can a beginner caster successfully target giant tarpon?
Well, if he's got
important
nerves of steel.
Question, huh?
If he's got nerves of steel and he's willing to fish after he pees all over himself, I would think so. But and if he can take a little bit of, you know, bowel breathing, beating from the guide, he probably can hold up to that. So if he's a tough guy, yeah, he may be able to. But I surely don't recommend homosassa as being the jumping off spot for beginner fly caster. You know, he's not going to have the numbers of opportunities in homosassa that he's going to get in a place like the Florida Keys. I mean, the numbers are going to be greater. Hey, we're constantly moving and looking for these fish. We don't have a particular pattern, a channel or route that they travel in. It's a broad area that they travel from north to south most of the time. There's not really what you call a stakeout area that the fish, you can sit and wait and know exactly where the fish are going to come from. So it makes it tougher when the boat's moving and a guy's got to, you know, make his cast and his strip accordingly. So it would be tough for Frank to pull that off. I think Frank might go away thinking that tarpon fishing may not be his game, and I think everybody needs to have an opportunity to catch a tarpon. And once they do, I certainly think they're hooked on it. But I think he would have better success fishing in areas that had better numbers, and the Florida Keys certainly has that. And I mention that because there's certainly plenty of places in Florida to catch tarpon. But, you know, the guides down there are so much better oriented to fly fishing, you know, for tarpon, and that would be my recommendation. Start there, graduate up to homosassa. If you've only got one trip to make in a lifetime, then maybe homosassa would be the place to do it, just to witness it. But if Frank's got some time, I would say Frank should start in the Keys.
Good advice. I know from personal experience, before I went down, I got some private casting lessons and tried to hone my skills and preparation for that, and kind of forgot everything when I was on the power of that boat casting, I tell you.
And it really, you know, Frank, and that's so true, it really needs to be secondary.
Yeah. What shakes you is when you see a pot of, you know, 8 or 10 100-pound plus fish coming at you, and you, like you say, you about wet yourself thinking about what might happen.
Well, and Roger, you've been there. Frank probably hasn't been there yet, but you know, it's a great experience no matter how you do it. A lot of times, you know, if Frank was to find him a friend that was get hooked up with a friend who's got some experience at it, let him give him some instructions, some teaching, and work with him on his casting. That it's very important. But there's so many things to learn once you get on that boat, and there's so many of those things that they're not secondary, that you're not going to be able to accomplish that. There's no doubt that tarpon, fly fishing for tarpon, is in my opinion the toughest inshore saltwater fishing that you can possibly do. No doubt about it. It will test you and tax you. But if you're prepared for it, it is by far the most exciting experience that you could have on the inshore waters.
That's for sure.
It pulls any harder. Nothing jumps any bigger. I mean, these are the giants of the inshore waters. So it's our big game of inshore fishing, and it is the biggest game of inshore fishing. So start out with some baby tarpon. They do the same things that the big guys do, but they just don't beat you up as bad, you know.
We
send Frank down to the Keys in the wintertime and let him catch some of the baby tarpon, 15 to 20 pound tarpon, 30 pound tarpon. He can graduate up and have a blast catching those fish.
Yeah.
And Mike, he's a lot about it at the same time.
Mike Adamson in Orlando again asks, are there ways that you approach tarpon in Homo sassa waters that are different than you might fish for them in the Keys or in Boca Grande?
Absolutely. I touched on that a while ago. We're fishing, Mike, we're fishing open water. Boca Grande, they're fishing the passes. The fly fishing guides are fishing on the beaches. They've got a little greener water. They're looking for the silhouettes, and they're looking for rolling fish, and they're getting in front of the fish and casting to them. We're setting up as we see the fish approach. We can see them usually further away because of our clear water, but we're maneuvering with the trolling motors and not with an outboard. And a lot of times in the Boca Grande area, they're just using the outboards and moving along until they see the fish. Shut down and coast into them, or turn a single trolling motor on the stern just to position himself a little better. We're strictly relying on our trolling motors and our push pole. We're doing a lot of work with our push poles along with dual trolling motors on the back to get set up, shut the motors down, and then we pole in place for the fish. Whereas they shut their outboards down and use a trolling motor to get in. But they're fishing over a lot deeper water than what we are. We don't do any staking out the Keys. 98%, I would say, of the guides in the Keys that tarpon fish are staking out, letting the fish come to them. So that's really how we differ here than in the Keys and in Boca Grande.
Okay, so, Earl, you're out there in the flats and you're looking. Are you looking for small schools like you would find in the Keys, or are you looking for single large fish?
We're looking for anything that swims. We're looking for anything that moves. It could be a big shark, because big sharks come in here following these tarpon schools around. We're looking for big cobia. We're looking for anything that moves, and then we want to narrow that identity down to whether it's a single tarpon or whether it's a school of tarpon. Because they are here, and they come in groups, we typically see the tarpon in groups. When we see a single fish, we look at him and kind of shake our head like, well, somebody just pulled that one out of a school. Should we cast to him? Yeah, we do, because we don't know that for sure. He may be just trying to catch up to a school. But typically a single fish is somewhat rare to catch, but you're usually catching them when they're in a school. You're looking for the movements. And these schools can be anywhere from a half a dozen fish to 400 or 500 fish. I mean, we typically see in the peak of the season schools that may run 60 to 100 fish in a school. You know, moving across the flats. So you can see these a long ways away, but they cover ground pretty fast. And you know, you got to be on top of your game to be able to make it happen.
Let's talk about that presentation. Don Bishop up in Montana says, please discuss the best way to deliver fly fast to a rapidly moving tarpon. Do you do much sidearm casting?
I would say that our best casting comes from sidearm casting, mainly because you're fishing in a 16 to an 18 foot skiff. You know, your guide's going to be perched on his poling platform in the back with a push pole, and he's going to become an obstacle for you in your back cast. His push pole's somewhat an obstacle. He's going to try to, you know, set the boat up for you as quick as possible, but sometimes fish move it to you from a blind area, and he's going to call the direction and the distance, and you're going to have to be right there, whether you see him or not. You're going to have to be as close to the proximity of the fish as you can. So sidearm is certainly the method that is used in the saltwater fishing. You know, for tarpon, 40 feet is a good distance. We certainly will throw at fish 60 feet away. If an angler gets out past 50 feet with his fly, he may not see that fly once it hits the water, and you're just really blind casting when you're not seeing your fly in relation to the fish. Very important to keep an eye on the fish in relation to your fly. You know, I know an angler in Wyoming, in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, who he's the luckiest guy in the world who can catch a tarpon blind casting to a school, and he just block shoots and pulls out fish when I think that he's never going to even get a bite. but he's done that a number of years because he doesn't really pick a fish. It is important to learn how to pick a fish, and it is important to work that particular fish and not try to work the school of fish. Your chances increase dramatically when you work a fish and not try to work the school.
Okay, so let's elaborate on that a little bit. If I see school coming in of seven fish, and let's say they're coming at me from 1 o'clock going across the bow of the boat, to like 9 o'clock or so, where do I cast into that school?
I hate that shot. I like that head-on shot. the reason.
Yeah, but how often do you get that?
Well, that's true. And we try to set ourselves up with the direction of the fish to where we can get that head-on shot. But you certainly get probably more of those opportunities than you get the head-on shots. And in that particular scenario, I am wanting that fly not in front of the lead fish, because usually when the fish are strung out there, there'll be one or two fish that's in the lead, and then they'll kind of be stacked a little thicker as you go back into school, and then it'll be somewhat of a flock type of formation, where there's less fish in the front and more fish in the middle and less fish in the back. And when seven fish are coming along, they're going to be fairly tightly grouped, but I'm going to pick that fish that's closest to me and to where that I don't when I put that fly in front of that school, I do not want to put that fly line across in front of that school and then bring it into them. That's the term that I used earlier called fencing. And my terminology behind that is if you've got a herd of cattle running across the pasture and they come to a fence line, they're going to bust through that fence line, or either they're going to stop or turn, and some of them will go one way and some will go the other way. And typically that's what the tarpon are going to do if you put the fly line out in front of them to where they can see it. You do get away with that more often with the monic clear fly line if it's already in the water. But if you make a presentation that comes down into the water, and as the fly line lays out in the water, it disturbs the water no matter what color it is or how clear it is. And that can be enough to disturb them. So I want the fly to be, I want the fly to be in that 1 o'clock. If I have to throw it to 12 o'clock, I'm pulling at 90 degrees. And that's at 90 degrees and more, you're really going the wrong direction. You really need to wait and try to get a better setup or get a better shot. If you can get a 45 degree angle on them, if you see those fish coming in, at 1 o'clock, and you can put that fly at any kind of angle other than 12 o'clock across the front of the fish, then you're certainly going to be able to get more lookers. And the idea being picking a fish that's on your side of the school, not on the far side, and putting that fly, in front of him in a distance that's going to predict his speed. Tarpon can move at a very slow speed. They can move at a very slow speed, and they can move at a very fast speed. So based on their speed is where that presentation has to be, and you really need to be there with somebody that can coach you through that if you've never done that. The scenario for me to say, well, it's got to be done this way, you should do it this way every time, I'd be telling you wrong. But to tell you as the scenario unfolds, it's much easier. As long as you can follow those instructions that I'm giving you and understand why I'm telling you to put it where I tell you to put it at is the important factor. And a lot of emphasis is put on the fly when really the presentation is really our key to catching tarpon. Presentation and the way we present the fly, the way we move the fly. If the fish are moving fast, you want that fly to stay in front of them. You never want the fish to swim up underneath the fly. You never want the fly to end up behind the fish, where the fish are going faster and expect one behind it to come up and eat it. That can happen, but you've disturbed the fish in front of them. If you disturb the fish in front of the school, you disturb the fish in the back of the school, because they'll react to what the fish are doing in front of them. They'll sense their movement.
So basically, it's kind of like from a generalist point of view is you want the fly to appear magically in front of a fish that's not in the middle but on the edge of the school, and that fly should be going away from them. And given that scenario, that's what you want to achieve no matter what the angle or what the conditions. That's the ideal situation.
My best scenario is to put that fly in the water in time enough that it sinks down to the water column that they're swimming at, where they're 2 feet or 3 feet or 4 feet under the surface, to where it's right in front of them when they approach it. The fly is suspended there. I'm not moving. I'm not stripping that fly. but I'm watching for a reaction of that fish that I'm trying to lead or a couple fish that I'm trying to lead. And if one of them shows the least bit of interest by turning his pectoral or rolling a little bit or turning his head, you'll see those subtle movements. And as soon as I see that movement, then I start to move that fly, and I increase the speed from a slow speed to a faster speed at whatever time it takes to keep it in front of him. I never let him overrun that fly, and he'll turn his body, he'll turn his pectorals to where he lines up with it. When you see that happening, now you can, as he approaches that, you can slow that fly down by making shorter movements, but quick movements, meaning what we call a twitch. You'll hear the term twitch a lot in tarpon fishing, where we're making a foot and a half long strip. The fish comes up behind the fly. Now we're making a 1-inch strip as fast as we can possibly strip 1 inch. And we're putting life into that fly. And something that's been used in recent years is where you actually wiggle the rod tip to put a little action into the fly, to where the fly kind of gets a shimmy shake to it, you know, where the fly is actually wiggling in the water. We used to never do that, but that seems to help entice them, particularly using the marabou type of, you know, tails on these toad flies. The mm-hmm. toad fly has a means to add some life to it with that marabou. So, you know, that helps entice them a lot of times, and then they come up under it. And anybody who's ever caught a tarpon can tell you that it's a very subtle take. They suck it in. It's just a tap that you feel. And then, you know, it's game on at that point.
Yeah, game on, right? A question from H.J. Lim in Jakarta, Indonesia. That's a bit away. What's the best way to increase hookup rates with tarpon?
Well, you know, I hate to be blunt, but the best way to increase hookup rates is throw to a lot of tarpon, because your percentages can certainly be tough on tarpon. But fly fishing for tarpon, you're going to get your highest percent of take up. And using a good hook. You know, I use the Owner SSW. It's designed as a bait hook. A lot of guys that fish conventional means for fish other than fly fishing use that hook. It's an up high hook. I tie it with a loop knot because I don't snell it, because that up high wouldn't allow you to snell it particularly. And I use that in a 5.0 and a 4.0, and I think that's like a 5311-151 and a 141 in the 4.0. But that Owner SSW is my hook of preference. It holds the big fish. It's got an offset a hook on it to where it grabs extremely well. That helps you get it into the corner of the mouth. One of the things that a trout fisherman will do is he'll usually strike a tarpon way too soon. When a tarpon comes up and opens his mouth and takes that fly, we strip strike that fly. We do not raise the rod as most trout fishermen would. A lot of the guys that are trout fishermen, when they first come during tarpon season, they've got that trout, you know, deal down so fast, it's lightning fast, of setting that hook, and it's just the opposite for us. We don't raise the rod tip. We strictly strip strike so that the fish has still got the fly in zone in case he misses it. Because when a tarpon moves on that fly, when he opens that mouth, he really doesn't see that fly any longer, and he's expecting that fly to go backwards and not continue to swim against the thrust that he's sucking through his gills. So when he does get the fly in his mouth and shuts his mouth, you'll feel a tap, and when you do, he's usually going to roll to the side, you know, when he does that, and that's when you're going to be able to come tight with your line and set up on him. That's going to increase your hook setting tremendously when you can do it that way.
Well, Earl, we're running out of time. There was I want to get a couple more squeezed in, so you have to keep your answer short. But Jay in Windermere, Florida, was asking about a better trolling motor setup for his flats boat. And I'm going to defer him to just talk to you directly about that, because I think that's a long, probably complicated, and I know you are an expert and have manufactured these things. So can he just contact you directly on that?
He can go online to Backcountry Concepts. He can look in our Air Troll section there. Air Troll is where we manufacture that product exclusively for what he's looking for.
Okay, great. Now, a couple quick answers on these questions. Frank Dalzell in Lanceville, British Columbia again. I have yet to book a guide. What questions should I ask when I talk to prospective guides? And I think that's a really good question.
Yeah. Are you sober at this time?
Yeah, are you sober? Yeah. Question number one, yeah. Will you be sober when I get there, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the best way I think, and the internet is certainly a great tool this time of day. You can interview the guide, you can look at his website, and his website can really dazzle you, but the best way is not to ask him for references, but to go on one of the blogs, some great places out there to go and research. I'm going to an area. I'm looking for a guide in that area. Give me some advice, folks. Here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a fly fishing guide, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the local fly shops that you're going to can certainly be a good avenue as well. But there's a lot of areas that are remote that don't have fly shops. So there's somebody has been to just about every place there is to go fly fishing. And if they haven't been, then they're probably not going to tell you about it anyway. So I would highly recommend for Frank to go online and research, just put in some keywords concerning where he's going and what he's wanting to do, and I think he'll find the kind of answers that he'll need. And then call the guide that's been recommended and talk to him, and then within 5 minutes he should feel comfortable or uncomfortable with the situation.
Okay, and then one final question here to wrap things up. When you're booking a guide, and this again by Frank, how long should I book, and I guess he means how long a period of time, how many days should I book to expect a reasonable opportunity of at least jumping a few tarpon, and I guess assuming that you have decent casting skills, right?
Exactly, and I think a guy, if he spends a minimum of 3 days, he's going to have a good experience. Naturally, if he can afford to do more than that, I would say to do so, but I think the people who just book 1 day to try to get it all in, the first day is an orientation day and a little bit tough, and they're getting a lot of things crammed down there. You know, their thought process is getting overloaded, and they're hearing a lot of information, so they can't process that until the second day. They sleep on it at night, process the second day. By the third day, they got it all, you know, together. And I've seen this a number of times, and I highly recommend to do a minimum of 3 days if you can. Certainly, a greater experience is going to be as many days as you can, but I wouldn't recommend anything less than 3 days unless budget doesn't permit that to happen.
Right. Great. Well, time to wrap things up here. But when we return, we're going to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and also that $20 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers. So stay tuned to see if you win. You've likely heard of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska's Bristol Bay region. This enormous open pit would generate as much as 3 billion tons of toxic waste in a seismic area which is home to the world's largest runs of wild salmon and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing in the planet. The world of fly fishing has rallied to this tremendous cause, but we need your help too. To learn more or to sign the Bristol Bay Conservation Petition, visit www.sportsmansalliance4ak.org. That's sportsmansalliance4ak.org. Or just Google Bristol Bay Mining. Get involved. Be proactive. Conservation helps the future of fly fishing. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage and just under Earl's section there where it says, what did you think of the show? Click on that link, leave a few comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away the prizes. We're going to do the drawing from our random drawing from our database for a 3-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers. So I'll have the computer go out and take a random drawing. And we got Grant Dixon in British Columbia. So congratulations, Grant, on that membership to the FFF, 3-year membership, and we'll get in contact with you about how we can get you hooked up with that. And then the second thing, and by the way, if you want to find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, just go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Now we have a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Great magazine. Their website is flyfusionmag.com, and the winner of that 1-year subscription is going to be Tim Bauer, or Bayer, Illinois. So congratulations, Tim, on that win. And now we're going to do the drawing, or not the drawing, but the answer to the question that I'm going to ask here about something we've talked about. And the first person answer this, and you answer this on our homepage there in that text box. Be sure to put in your answer plus your name and your location to qualify for this. And the first person that gets the answer and wins the correct answer, and I'll make sure that Earl verifies that this is the correct answer here. So we're ready to go on that. The question is, what is the most effective and most often used fly that Earl uses for tarpon? Now that's an easy one. Even if you got the second and the third answer, you'd still get the same answer, right, Earl?
That's correct. Can't go wrong with that one.
So we'll make it easy on you guys tonight and gals. Just give me an answer for that one. You get a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So, Jared in Holland, Michigan. Jared's fast. He's won these before, I believe. But he says, tell me if he's correct here, Earl. He says, toad fly in purple, black chartreuse, and red/white.
There you go. He's right.
Boy, that's a pretty complete answer, right? He wasn't going to miss that one. Well, Jared, send me your email address in that same box so that I can communicate with you afterward, and we'll get that certificate off to you. Well, Earl, hey, thank you so much for spending your valuable time with us tonight. I sure learned a lot, and I always like talking about tarpon.
Boy,
it's exciting just to talk about them.
Nothing better than talking about tarpon fishing other than fishing for tarpon. Much rather
that's
fish for
it.
Them, but can't fish for them, we talk about them. And wanted to mention to you also quickly that we got everything from tent camping all the way up to luxury camp, our luxury lodging that can run from $75 to $115 a night, so we got plenty of good lodging available here as well.
Good, good, and they can just contact you if they want some recommendations.
Absolutely.
On that.
Absolutely.
So, great, great. Yeah, thanks for sharing that with us. Well, hopefully we can talk about tarpon again sometime with you, Earl, and I hope you see a bunch of us down there in your boat. So thanks again for sharing your information.
Looking forward
to
it, and thank you very much for having me on the program tonight.
Great, great. Thank you. Our next broadcast will be on January 21st, and that's going to be 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we're going to interview Dave Hughes, and our topic for the show will be nymphs for streams and still waters. Dave Hughes shares his secrets he's learned over a lifetime of fishing nymphs in both streams and still waters. So listen in to hear how he makes fishing with nymphs simple, direct, and effective. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.